Good morning. I'm Charlie Meyerson, and our guest this morning on Point of View is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times syndicated columnist Anna Quindlen, whose work appears every Tuesday in the Chicago Tribune, among many other places. Her new book is a collection of those essays. It's called Thinking Out Loud. Welcome to Chicago.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back.
Glad to have you back. You've been on the campaign trail for this book on and off for weeks now, Boston, Atlanta, Washington, New York, of course, Chicago. What do you want to talk about? What aren't they asking you out there that you wish they'd ask you? What should we talk about today?
Well, it's not so much what we should talk about as some of the things that have gotten a little tired. I've probably been asked 100 times about the 100 days of Bill Clinton, or alternatively, the 100 days of Hillary Clinton. And I must say, I'm beginning to feel like this 100 days construct that we set up, which admittedly journalists set up in the beginning, it's really tough on the president.
It's an artificial measurement.
Exactly. It could just as easily be 258 days or 365 days. So I've been asked about that an awful lot. And the truth is that it changes so much. The president's position changes so much day by day, week by week.
More so with this president than with other presidents?
I think to some extent, yeah. Mm-hmm. Part of it is this scattershot approach that he's getting criticized for so much, which is that he's trying to do so many different things at one time, so that on any given day, you don't know whether front burner is going to be dealing with the Serbs, trying to hammer out a health care accord, the stimulus package, or some, you know, shouting match that he gets in with Bob Dole. So I do think that the answer in terms of how Clinton's doing varies widely depending on when you ask.
Now, I've heard those same sorts of objections raised from a number of people, that 100 days isn't really a fair judge, especially for a president who set that sort of agenda. Do you find an argument, a refuge of liberals or at least reformers looking to put the best light on Clinton's performance?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that fact. But the other thing is, the reason that 100 days seems like an unfair construct to me is not just because he's a liberal Democrat. It's because of what he's following, what he's coming after. And so much of his work seems to me, from my political point of view, to have to be redressing the injuries of the last 12 years. I mean, some of that's been relatively simple. The abortion initiatives that he took when he first came into office, in terms of overturning the gag rule, allowing fetal tissue research, permitting RU486 in this country, a variety of things, were simply saying, this is what's taken place over the last 12 years, and we're going to get rid of this wholesale. But turning some of the rest of it on its axis is going to take a lot more time. I mean, when you look at the extent to which the federal deficit has swollen and in fact, burst over the last three Republican administrations, the idea of trying to tackle it in any meaningful way is sort of fearsome.
I wonder if we're seeing sort of the inverse of the phenomenon that was referred to in the 70s as it took Nixon to go to China. You had to have a conservative, anti-communist president, and it repeated with Reagan, really, to make the sort of breakthroughs with the enemy, the communists in this case, that perhaps a liberal president, a Democrat, might not have been able to make, might not have been able to push through Congress back home. Are we seeing the reverse of that with Clinton? You have an avowed liberal in the White House trying to bring about changes that that might be more easily achieved if they were proposed by a conservative president.
I think more of this is a function of where the heads of the people are at. I mean, I just think the deficit became such a huge part of the process when Perot got involved that it was clearly something that any president, liberal or conservative at this point, was going to have to take on.
What else? How would you, in general, assess Clinton? Not necessarily at the 100-day point, but based on his performance so far. Is he living up to what you might have perceived as his, or you or others might have perceived as his potential?
He's all over the map. I mean, on certain things, I think he's done most poorly. On certain things, I think he's done superbly and exactly what I expected. As I mentioned before, on the abortion rights front, he's been exactly what I expected and hoped. In terms of how he's treated the Haitians, and the question of the HIV exclusion for immigrants, I'm disappointed. In terms of the question of gays in the military, it's sort of interesting I expected him to come in and lift the ban and not have the kind of dialogue about it that we've had. Having said that, I think the dialogue has been extraordinarily useful. I think it's raised some consciousness. I think it's caused people to come out who wouldn't have come out otherwise, and whose coming out really tells people something about what it means to be gay and in the military in this country. And I think it's let people know how much they don't know about this extremely hot issue. On the economic package, I think he's all over the map. I think his original sell was good. I think his emphasis on the deficit is good. I think, obviously, he lost big on the stimulus package, and we have still to see how the American people are going to respond if he comes back with a health care package that sounds good, but that costs a bundle.
This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Myers, and our guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Anna Quinlan. After all these years of writing about the news, tracking and critiquing politicians, do you ever, I wonder particularly now that you're a parent, as you have been for several years, get the urge to break that sort of invisible barrier that often separates journalists from the process, from the agencies that they cover, whether it's school boards or political organizations or all the rest of it?
You mean, do I ever get the end run for something?
Do you ever get the urge to run for office, for instance, or to take a more active role in the sorts of agencies that, as a street reporter, at one point, you probably would have avoided?
Well, as a street reporter still, because I do a lot of street reporting for my column, but I feel like being an opinion column is such an opinion columnist is such an active role, as opposed to being a street reporter, that's really the role I want to play and the role I'm comfortable in. I can't imagine ever running for anything. I mean, my family's exposed enough now as it is, but I control that exposure in large measure, and having them be subject to what I've seen other families be subject to just would not be what I would want for them. I still have a clear sense of personal privacy about my personal life.
Yeah, it shows in your column, or doesn't show in your column in a lot of ways. You took a couple of years off from column writing, 1988 to 1990. Now, what happened? Tell our listeners what happened to you intellectually, professionally in that time. And during that period, were you assured of a return to the Times if you wanted it, when you wanted it?
Yes, actually, by the time that I gave up Life in the 30s, my last column, which I stopped doing the week that our third child, Maria, was born, the publisher and I had already talked in a general way about me coming back as an op-ed page columnist about a year and a half later, because I was cleaning up the final draft of a novel I was working on then. So I knew that I was going to come back, even though no one else did, and although I had originally planned to leave the Times permanently and just write fiction. I remember that time very fondly, and I'm coming up on a time that's going to be a little bit like it, because what nobody really gets about this job is that you do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, I only write two columns a week, and I think from the outside that must look pretty easy. But there's a part of your brain that attaches when you're a columnist in which you look at everything through this scrim of, can I use that? Does that hook up with anything else I've seen to make a full column?
What was the quote from your husband?
Could you get up and get me a beer without writing a column about it? I mean, your entire life becomes fodder, and you never look at the world without this particular scrim, which is why in July, August, and September, I'm taking a three-month leave of absence from the paper to finish my second novel, because the only way that I feel that I can do it is to get away from the column writing.
And then to return to the column?
Yeah.
Public and private?
Absolutely. I promised the publisher I would, and I will.
I know you get this question. Any writer gets this question a lot, but the audience wants to know. Inquiring minds want to know. What do you do when you run out of ideas? Or do you run out of ideas?
It hasn't happened over the last 3 years.
I find that astonishing.
Well, no. If you thought about the last 3 years, the way that you have to think about it as a column writer, you'd understand why. Mm-hmm. We careened from one national dialogue crisis hot-button issue to another, so that over the last 3 years, we've had the Persian Gulf War, the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, the presidential campaign, complete with Jennifer Flowers, the draft, the alleged trip to Moscow.
Highlight after highlight.
Highlight after highlight. huge controversies about abortion, huge controversies about the role of gay people, huge controversies about the role of organized religion, about the press itself, about the homeless, about the poor, so that, you know, they say sometimes we're cursed to live in interesting times. Boy, as a columnist, I'm blessed to live in interesting times.
Well, I've dabbled in column writing on occasion, and one of the concerns that I would think would occupy you is, you read other columnists, you read other newspapers, do you feel a certain compulsion, if you read an opinion in someone else's column, to take a slightly different position, or does that invalidate a given approach to an issue for you when it comes time to, for you to write about it?
You know, that hasn't been that much of a problem for me, because a lot of the people writing about politics or world events who are columnists right now tend to have an insider's view. And by that, I don't mean that they're part of the process, but I mean that they know so much of the people involved inside and out, and always have. And for me, much more of my work is based on trying to get a sense of what ordinary people are thinking about news stories and cutting-edge issues. And so I don't feel like I butt up against my colleagues so much. On occasion, Ellen Goodman and I will cover a lot of the same area, and I don't think that's because we're female or not directly. It's because both of us, she much before I did, carved out this way of looking at the political in terms of the personal that makes us in some ways alike.
This is Point of View, WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Meyerson talking to syndicated columnist Anna Quinlan. Your columns run in how many papers nationwide, including the Tribune here in Chicago?
We're not really sure. It's somewhere over 100, but it could be 160, 170, or closer to 200.
Do you lose control over your material when it goes through so many editors, so many different filters on its way out to the hinterlands?
You mean at the syndicate papers or in the Times?
Well, at the syndicate papers, not the Times itself. I assume you have quite a bit of control over the way things
appear
in the Times.
Yeah, I only have one editor who's a copy editor at the Times, who edits basically for punctuation.
But it goes out to so many other papers. It's presented, I have to assume, in a number of different ways and forums. Does that ever cause problems for you?
I don't like it very much when people cut. I mean, I understand why they have to do it, but they have a real clear problem with my copy, which is that I tend to write pieces so that each sentence somehow links into the next sentence, so that I like to think of my style as a kind of a seamless garment approach, and that means when you cut it, you see the seams.
So any particular horror stories where you feel that you've been, your work has been done substantial damage by an editor at another paper?
I wouldn't call them horror stories. We just got a letter from a lady who was reading a column I'd written about banning books, and she said to her husband, "Boy, you know, this last sentence is a killer." And he said, "Really? I don't know. I don't see it that way," or something. And they were going back and forth. Well, she was reading the Times. He was reading their local paper. And the column was three sentences shorter than it had been in its first incarnation.
Well, they chop off the ending.
The last sentence was a killer, but he didn't have it in his copy.
The Tribune runs your column every Tuesday. Any comments on the Trib, the way it runs your column, reaction you get to your column from Chicago?
The Tribune has just been a fabulous market for me ever since I was doing Life in the 30s. And the people who run the paper just couldn't possibly have been better in terms of how they've treated me and how they've run the column. This is probably the only city in America in which people regularly recognize me on the street. Because in New York, there's no picture, there's no sense of, you know, in New York, if you're a journalist, you're not that high up on the food chain. One of the things that I've noticed here is the columnists in Chicago have a real particular and elevated niche. I mean,
we hold them in high esteem.
Yeah,
here.
You sure do. And when I come here, it makes me feel great.
Now, you're here in Chicago. I'm going to ask you this question anyway. You were quoted in USA Today this week, maybe other places, as being a little, well, expressing concern about the use of women's sections or the play of so-called women's news in papers around the country. Here in Chicago, the Trib has the woman news section.
Right.
What do you have to say about that?
Well, but
you don't run in that section.
It's not women's news. That's what we've got it any more than, as I said, sports is men's news. I mean, I read a lot of the stuff in the sports section.
I read more of women news than I do in the sports section.
I don't like titles that are exclusionary. The thing that I hated about Life in the 30s is that it disinvited people to read the column. I must have gotten 100 letters from people that began, "I'm 52 years old, so I probably shouldn't be reading your column." And I'd think, no, 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 no. You don't ever want to be exclusionary. And especially, you don't want to invite men out of all the areas in which we don't think they sufficiently participate, like childcare, like the life of the home and the emotions. So that I think titles that are exclusionary in that way do women a disservice and do men a disservice too. I think that section is really good.
It's a
woman
section.
News section. I'm just not crazy about the title.
This is Point of View, WNUA 95.5. Our guest is New York Times columnist and Pulitzer Prize winner Anna Quinlan. I'm Charlie Myers. And tell us about winning the Pulitzer Prize. You've done this story 100 times, but what happens when you win the Pulitzer
Prize? Best feeling you ever have with your clothes on, let me tell you.
You did have your clothes on at the time,
didn't
you?
My clothes on. I was sitting in my office at the Times, which is very unusual since most of the time I work at home. And the Western Union calls you at exactly 3 o'clock.
Western Union.
It's much better that way. It's like a movie musical because they call you and they ask if it's you and then they read you the telegram over the phone. And then the next day you get the telegram in the flesh, which I now have actually framed and is over my desk.
As you should.
The only sign of hubris or conceit on my part. I like that telegram.
Your desk is at home.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us, I mean, how do you work? You do most of your writing at home.
Yeah, I write almost exclusively when my kids are at school. So I take them to school in the morning, and then I usually work from about 9 o'clock till about 4 o'clock in a pretty concerted fashion. No lunch break, anything like that. I get a lot done. I'm very focused now. One or two days a week, I'm either out on the street doing street reporting or doing interview stuff at my office at the Times, and 2 days a week I'm actually sitting there writing the column, Tuesday for Wednesday and usually Friday for Sunday.
You've hit the bestseller book. I don't think I'm wrong about this. You've hit the bestseller list with every book you've written so far, right?
No, I haven't. What did I miss, or what did you miss? Living Out Loud, my first collection of Life in the 30s columns, didn't make the list, although if you took all the copies that it sold over the space of its existence, because it's still in print and hardcover and still selling, and smooshed them all together, it would clearly go on the list.
All right. Well, everyone since then. a couple of fiction books, one for children, one for adults.
Right.
Both made the bestseller list. Well, and we don't know about this one yet, do we?
Oh, no, we
Object
do.
List.
No, it went on the list
on.
The first week that
That's
it
right.
was. It went on the Times list. And,
I knew I saw
and
that.
And it was on Sunday in the number 8 spot.
Well, what do you do for an encore? You're working on a novel now.
Right.
Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, it's sort of at that mushy period where I really hate it. But it's really a book about the relationship between fathers and daughters and how complicated that can be. But it's set within the context of a woman being accused of the assisted suicide of her mother during her last illness with an overdose of morphine. And it's sort of a difficult and dark book, but I think it says some important things about how we treat our children within the context of our marriages and our relationships with them. And I mean, I was so shocked when Object Lessons went on the list because I've read 100 great first novels that didn't sell more than 5,000 or 6,000 copies. So it always comes as a pleasant surprise to me when it happens. But I'd say with fiction that I'm just always so happy to actually have done it that I'm not going to waste my time too much wondering about where it winds up.
You mentioned earlier that when you left your first column, Life in the 30s, your intent was to concentrate largely on writing fiction.
Write fiction full time.
Now, you've written some fiction and continue to write, of course, your fact-based column. Do you see yourself splitting the rest of, at least the near future of your writing career down the middle like that, or do you see yourself veering one direction or another?
Well, it's a real nice way to go because you get the immediate gratification from the column. I guess I shouldn't say gratification because sometimes the mail is overwhelmingly negative, but at least, you know, you immerse yourself totally in this subject, you write your 750 words and it's in the paper the next day, as opposed to the couple of years that a novel takes and sort of the long string of of plot tension that you have to bring to it. So it makes a nice balance for me. I'm not sure in the future exactly how much longer I'll be able to do the column, only because I think columnists really burn themselves out pretty quickly.
This is Point of View on WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Meyerson, and our guest is Anna Quinlan, columnist, author. What else do you do? I mean, do you have any other projects in the fire? Largely, we're talking about books and work in print. Anything else you're working on?
Oh, no. I mean,
no movie options for the book?
You know, well, options may come along. We're working on a deal for Object Lessons. But I can't see myself ever doing screenplays or anything like that. It's just not what I do. It's an honorable line of work, but it's not mine.
Dave Barry was here a few months ago. He said that they want to do a situation comedy based, a TV series based on his life. Has anyone come to you and
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. We had a pilot.
That's right. I remember reading about this.
For Living Out Loud.
What happened?
Which actually was a splendid pilot. Well, you know, they make a gazillion pilots, yeah. And then they go with the show about the two pro wrestlers who become private detectives.
Who was in there? Now, did they film a pilot? Is it out there?
No, we had a pilot script, and we were getting ready to do casting, and then ABC decided to go with something else, which I felt
buckets.
Terrible about, because the person who wrote the pilot did a really wonderful job. I couldn't have possibly dreamed up as fully fleshed a story about a family in which the mom writes an opinion column, as she did beautifully.
So is that a dead prospect at this point? Is there any continuing interest?
There's
in
talk from time to time about resuscitating it. I wouldn't say it's a dead project, but it's in a persistent vegetative state.
Yeah. This is Point of View, WNUA 95.5. I'm Charlie Myers, and our guest is Anna Quinlan. You're working your new column, and I guess I use the phrase new loosely. You've been doing it since 1990?
Yeah, 3 years.
Seems, by and large, and this is just my perception, I don't know whether it's accurate or not, to be more serious on average, more sober more often than life in the 30s was. By design? Is that the way your interests are going?
It's not by design, unfortunately. I was thinking the other day, boy, Anna, you know, let's mix it up a little more. Let's have some yucks here. But so many of the issues that I felt compelled to deal with over particularly the last year, because in the first year or two, I did more of mixing it up in terms of the light and the heavy columns, just are things that lend themselves to a more serious treatment. You know, I'm hoping to do one or two funny ones before I go on leave, but so far I've gotten sort of bollocksed up by Bosnia and Haiti. And
you and the president and everyone else.
That's right.
Yeah. What columnists, contemporary columnists, or for that matter historically, columnists do you most enjoy reading? Or have you most enjoyed reading?
Well, historically, the person who had the greatest effect on me growing up and thinking I might want to go into this business was Dorothy Thompson, who is really often forgotten at this point, or confused with Dorothy Parker, from whom she was most different,
mm-hmm.
but who wrote probably the second most powerful syndicated column in America during the 40s and some of the 50s, after Walter Lippmann. People used to say she was the second most powerful woman after Eleanor Roosevelt, because she was a very passionate columnist. She could often be very strident, but in a way that really was persuasive. And she really mixed it up in terms of saying, you know, all right, enough about the League of Nations. Let's talk about gardening. And I like the freedom that she allowed herself, based on the notion that she was quite gifted, and she did a good job, and therefore she should be able to get away with what she wanted to get away with. And I was always very impressed by the fact that she was married to Sinclair Lewis, who I think is a most underrated novelist. Contemporarily, I mean, there's so many good people out there. Obviously, Russell Baker, I mean, mm-hmm. who proves that you don't have to burn yourself out if you're a columnist. Ellen Goodman, who's sort of not old enough to be the mother of us all, but is kind of the big sister of us all.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Cohen of the Washington Post, whose Pulitzer, in my opinion, is long, long overdue. I just think there's so many good people out there. I think George Will is so intelligent, even though obviously politically we're not on the same wavelength. Barry, I mean, Dave Barry, I don't think I've ever read a column of his without starting to cry because I was laughing.
Yeah.
I just think he's a terrific person.
But you're not in that band he's with, are you?
The Rock Bottom Remainders? No, I'm not. I passed on it. You know, it's odd because I'm a person who loves to be silly and who really loves to laugh about this whole very serious situation in which we find ourselves writing this serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then I worry that I'll go over the top and be a little too silly, so I backed off on the Rock Bottom Remainders, even though I hear that they're terrific.
I haven't heard them perform myself. Your new book, as you know, and our audience may know, is called Thinking Out Loud. Before we bid you farewell, what's your favorite column in this particular collection?
Well, I think the pat answer is your favorite column is the one you're going to write next week.
Yeah.
It's actually going to conform to your fantasy of how good you really are. But one of the columns that I'm fondest of is the last column in this book, which is a column that I wrote about
my daughter's
second birthday called The Glass Half Empty. I'm still real attached to that column in a way that I'm still real attached to the daughter.
And I hope it remains that way always. Our guest on Point of View, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Anna Quinlan, whose new book is Thinking Out Loud. It's a collection of her columns, many of which have appeared, as her work does, every Tuesday in the Chicago Tribune. The book is $22, published by Random House. I'm Charlie Meyerson. Thanks for listening.